Hello and welcome to Unusual Sources. Today we have a really exciting interview. A theme that we have explored on our show is the use of the humanitarian intervention rhetoric as an excuse for foreign intervention. We are inundated with stories of human suffering in the media, with the only solution often being military reprisals. The term genocide is often thrown around as a reason for these interventions, as we have a responsibility to protect. Today on the show, we have Robin Philpott, a journalist, author, and politician. He has done extensive research on Rwanda and has written the book Rwanda, 1994, Colonialism Dies Hard. It is clear that what happened in Rwanda is a tragedy, but are we really getting the whole story? Hey, hello, Robin. Welcome to the show. Sorry about the little technical glitch. We often have them on the show.
Oh, I know. That happens.
Yes, it does.
How are you,
Jessica? I'm good. Thank you so much for coming on the show. So,
as I introduced
to the audience today, we're obviously going to be talking about Rwanda, and this is a very controversial topic because of the narrative surrounding the Rwandan genocide. Is something that's become a consensus in English Canada. People like Paul Kagame and Romeo Dallaire have become heroes in both the media and popular culture. You still skillfully dissect this narrative, and I would first like to ask you about the current president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, a little bit about his background and also his connections with the United States and the Ugandan government.
Yeah, well, you might, you know, talking about the narrative, that he and others wrote the narrative before things happened. I mean, he was an exile, member of the exiled Tutsi monarchist family, the family I'd say in a large sense, that were thrown out of Rwanda in 1960 when they had when Rwanda became independent and they had what they call a social revolution. A social revolution in the early in the 60s, and this minority had run Rwanda for hundreds of years, the monarchy, and it was living. They had the rest of the population, most majority of Hutus, were living in serfdom. It was a feudal monarchy, and with the independence, they made this big move forward, where it was made a republic. But this minority, especially around the royal family and others, just never accepted that, and they were in Uganda, and they were at the heart of Uganda's army in the 1980s, when Museveni, who's current president, has been president since he took power militarily in 1986, he based his taking power on these what I would almost call mercenaries, which were Rwandan exiled Tutsis, and they took power in 1986, and at the time when this group of people who later became the Rwandese Patriotic Front invaded on October 1st, 1990, the Minister of Defense was the head of what became the RPF, and the head of military intelligence, Paul Kagame. He was head of military intelligence of the Rwandan army. And then all of a sudden they mutated into a so-called Rwandan force. But really, in fact, they were regiments, entire regiments of the Ugandan army that invaded Rwanda in 1990, October 1990.
Yes.
And they had a prolonged war. So in other words, that's where they came from.
Well, yes, and that's sort of the original conflict that sort of sparked the conflict in Rwanda, as you mentioned, is that the RPF actually invaded Rwanda.
Exactly.
Go on. I just wanted you to explain a little bit about that for our listeners and why this is ignored in the media.
Well, it's ignored. They invaded, and they were uniform wearing. In other words, they were part of the Ugandan army, and they supposedly left the barracks, but they were left with the support, because you don't have 4,000 troops walking out of your barracks and crossing into the neighboring country, heavily armed, without it being, getting some kind of support from the government of Uganda and the army itself. So here, in other words, but that was just people just ignore that business because that destroys this, that makes the story. The story doesn't hold any longer if you have this group of people invading a country. And at the time, in 1990, October 1990, people thought, oh, well, they're going to take power immediately, but the Rwandans fought back. And the RPF set up, basically occupied a small section of Rwanda, a small country already, but a small section in northeastern Rwanda. And from there, they led guerrilla attacks. And they started building up terrorist cells within Rwanda from October 1990 right through until 1994, which is the period that everybody has heard about.
Yes, and you write in your book that during this period, Kagame specifically had various connections within the United States. Is that right?
Well, when this invasion occurred, Paul Kagame was being trained at Fort Leavenworth, I can't remember, was it Kansas or Arkansas? Kansas.
Yes. I'm not exactly sure where it is, yes.
Yeah, but it's slipping my mind. But he was training. He'd been there for what they call the EMET.
And is there actual documentation of this? Like, I think you provide that in your book, yeah.
It's common knowledge. In fact, in the United States, where people sometimes don't mind seeing themselves as imperialists, they're very proud of the fact.
Yes.
He was trained in the best schools, the best military schools, and that's all the books that congratulate him keep saying, well, he was, he's a good man because he was well trained in American military ways, you see. So, anyway, the ties were very close. And right from the we're talking about Bush number one, George Bush senior, they were already saw Uganda at the time and Kagame as being the future for Central Africa. They saw it as a way of getting against Sudan. If you look at the geography, Sudan is north of Uganda.
And that we'll later discuss the Congo, right? That was also,
and
yes.
They saw, and many people said, that invasion, October 1st, 1990, now we're talking 4 years before the period which has been since qualified as the genocide, people were saying already that invasion is not aimed at Kigali, but at Kinshasa, which is the capital of Congo, then called Zaire. So there was a very major, geopolitical strategy going on.
Well, yes. I'd like to get into that. How much there was this strategy, particularly with what everyone seems to. There's a consensus that what sparked the conflict in Rwanda was, or like at least the so-called genocide, was the assassination of the president, Habyarimana. And in your book, you outline that this assassination was basically part of a larger international campaign. Can you explain how and why?
Yeah, to say the assassination was part of an international campaign, you might say that it's the logical outcome.
Yes,
it'd be hard to settle and to prove immediately that had been planned. I mean, there are a lot of people who speculate.
Even the judges that have, investigate this, and the former UN Secretary General have said that there's something weird about this, right?
The former Boutros Ghali, who I interviewed twice, told me, and then once again, this we're talking about hearsay, and I don't know whether it would stand up in court, but he said that Bruguière, the French judge, anti-terrorist judge, said to him that the CIA was involved in the shooting down of the plane. But I think it's important to see how the conditions were built up. You have, between 1990 and 1994 to create a situation, which then created Dallaire as well, is that this fighting went on, and the RPF, with their international support, basically from London and Washington, managed to force the governor of Rwanda to negotiate. In other words, it's something that no the British and Americans would never have done it if it were their own country was at stake. Canada would never have done it. But they forced the Rwandan government, who had been the attacked party, to sit down and negotiate with this group of, which you can, I can quite clearly call a terrorist group, which, and they'd broken all international law and broken the principles of the Charter of the African Union, which says you can't harbor refugees and support attacks, you know, because their countries were created in post-colonial period. So this war went on from 1990 to 1994. In 1993, and I know you want to discuss what the role of some NGOs are, and
yes,
I'll tell you more about it, but what happened
later
in 1993, they made a major offensive in 1993 and took over almost a third of Rwanda, and they'd forced a million people from their homes in northern Rwanda, and they were living in camps around Kigali. This was in February 1993. Now, when they did that, they used as a pretext to make this major offensive a report done by Human Rights Watch, Rights and Democracy of Canada, and the International Federation of Human Rights in Paris. And that report, where some of the authors were Canadian-American, there was a guy named Shabas and Alison DeForge and others, that report became the basis on which the previous Rwandan government was denigrated, was attacked, was demonized, and still is demonized. But that report was, the people who organized that were actually members and supporters of the RPF within Rwanda. And so here you have these NGOs going in there for two weeks. Some of them had never been to Africa in their life. They didn't know anything about Rwanda, some of them. They supposedly went on a neutral investigation. None of them spoke, I don't think any of them spoke Kinyarwanda, which is the language there. They spent 2 weeks there, and only 2 hours behind the RPF lines where they were occupying almost a third of the country, only 2 hours, and their report became the basis of a Canadian decision to stop supporting the government, to stop any kind of cooperation with the Rwandan government. This is in 1993, and basically was a way to demonize that government right through until the 1994, so that when the plane was shot down and the RPF tried to take over Kigali, nobody was prepared to stand up and protect a government because they had been so demonized. And if anybody, which I tried to do, I analyzed that report. It shows how shoddy it was done. It was from the, and even, the, for instance, the Federal Court of Appeal of Canada has come to a decision in the case of a guy named Leon Mugesera.
Yes.
It was very, very, very shoddy work, that report.
And this I just find this unbelievable, and specifically the fact that how are NGOs going into a country and taking sides in a military conflict? And, you know, are these, you know, specifically in Rwanda, are they somehow agents of, you know, imperial powers in some ways? Like, why are they going in and taking sides in a military conflict?
Well, I think it's you know, and I don't want to just put everybody down who wants to do good, because
yes,
you know, it's you know, I understand it, but unfortunately their money comes from governments, and they come from big governments, Canada, United States, England, and others, and that necessarily affects their reports. I mean, they cannot come out; they will get cut off. Their funding will be cut off if they actually try and say, well, listen, this is wrong. You know, there are so many cases of people and organizations which have they do all kinds of self-censorship and refuse to say the truth because they know that they can just disappear the next day.
And like you
say,
some
of them have got careers in this, you know.
Yeah, and like you say in your book too, that these people, that these NGOs, they hadn't been in Rwanda previous to this, so they came into a situation that they knew very little about, and then were.
Sure, and a lot of them were English speaking, you know, and whereas the country had been a French speaking country since about 1960, 18, the French had been the language of education and so on. And so all of a sudden these people showed up, and there's a lot of prejudice towards French-speaking countries. I mean, even among Africans, I've noticed that. So they come in, and they know that they have to defend on the goodwill of the big powers. Otherwise, they are not. Now, in that group that we made that report in February 1993, if you see followed their trail after, some of them were actual members of the RPF. One guy, a guy from France, Jean Carbonari, was a member of the RPF.
Wow.
He showed up on the 19th of July when the RPF took power and was working for them. Others have remained defenders of Kagame and RPF right until today. And this guy, William Chabas, is still about the only one who goes and defends in court the current Rwandan government and favors extradition of Rwandans from England or elsewhere to Rwanda, whereas everybody, including Amnesty International, has said that if they get extradited, their lives will be in danger. So these people who worked on that report ended up being basically flax for the Rwandan government. It's obvious. I just want to say also was like, how is the Dallaire came into being was that in the summer of 1993, after having forced the government to negotiate, they reached a peace agreement, you know, a power-sharing peace agreement between the RPF and the Rwandan government. Whose president was Habyarimana. Many people saw it as Habyarimana had given too much ground, but they reached that peace agreement, and so that's when they decided to, and of course under that they sent in some UN peacekeeping force, which was supposed to be something like 4,500, and they ended up only moving in 2,000, and they chose a general from Canada. The United States wanted a general in there who was not with France, but was French-speaking. That's why Dallaire was chosen, because they realized that in order to take over a French-speaking country, they had to at least pay some kind of attention to the fact. And so they had the people who spoke French, but it couldn't be France, because one of their goals was to get France out of it, replace France as the influential power in the central part of Africa.
Well, and this is what I want to get into in the next part of our interview, is that,
sure,
you know, the motivations. We've touched a little bit about the strategic element of Rwanda, but every time I sort of talk with friends about Rwanda, they always ask me, well, why, you know, this is a big conspiracy theory, why did the United States want to get involved in Rwanda? What is the attraction of Rwanda to foreign powers?
Well, I think that, I mean, you know, there's a lot better specialists on the military questions than I am. But one of the things that the Americans have learned is that you sometimes better to rely on a proxy army to make the law in a certain regions of the world than to send their own troops in. Their experience with Israel has been that. Their experience right now with, you know, what I understand is Colombia, in the area in the northern part of South America, and the role that Colombia plays the watchdog, the guard for that whole area.
Mm-hmm.
They saw that Museveni was the strong man. In fact, I have quotes of somebody from the Secretary of State speaking to a French journalist who said, "The strong man in Africa is no longer Mobutu," who's in Kinshasa, "but Museveni in Kampala." And so they felt that here you had this almost called a phalange type army in Uganda, and this group of mercenaries who were basically the Rwandans who were exiled and in Uganda, who could take power. And if you look at it since, I mean, it's, you know, a conspiracy theory. Rwanda doesn't have a lot of wealth, but Rwanda,
yes,
right now, the Rwandan government, the Rwandan army, and people tell me, very reliable sources, that they have an army of 100,000 people. Now, Canada's army is 50,000. Rwanda is about the size of the island of Montreal. if not maybe a bit bigger. And you have an army of 100,000.
And it's
that
being
army
used
is there for what?
And yeah, know? And it's already being used, which I guess we can talk about a little bit now, in interventions in other parts of Africa, such as the Congo. Am I not correct in saying that?
Yeah. In the Congo, and then when they set up this force in Sudan as well.
Yes.
They put it under the leadership of a Rwandan general who had been involved in some of the worst massacres in Central Africa, Karake Karenze, and he was. So they sent part of this army up into Sudan. Basically, their goal is to dismantle Sudan. And what they have done in the Congo is one of these this forgotten war, where there have been many more people killed and had been killed during the spring of 1994.
Yeah, and.
So,
and this,
you know, the wealth. I mean, I've had people who've shown how Kigali's become very wealthy. The rest of Rwanda is extremely poor, but they have, of course, the producing of wealth of mineral wealth that is transits via Kigali is instead of going by from the Congo, from Eastern Congo, in a very, very wealthy area of the world.
There's gold and other sort of diamonds, I believe, in that in the Congo.
And coltan,
yes,
which is, you know, and very much very important resources, and so they're going through the Congo. There's been a book. There are several books out about this, about the exploitation of Eastern Congo. So you might say that it's been carried. There was a lot of interest, a lot of wealth to be had by having an army in there that was completely devoted to the United States, because the United States put them in there, and also ruthless, which is the case of Kagame.
Well, and this leads into my next question with the connection to colonialism, and the United States is sort of like the new reluctant empire, as you sort of put it, like Britain was. And this was an interesting part of the book that I found, that humanitarian intervention is linked to the old rhetoric of colonialism.
Yeah.
Specifically, you know, how they used to justify colonialism on the basis of ending evils like slavery.
Right.
How has this colonial pattern been replicated in Rwanda?
Yeah, well, you know, while I was preparing for this discussion, I was rereading things that you know, our leader of the Liberal Party, Michael Ignatieff, was writing at those. In
yes,
those,
R2P.
Those
yes, I he used. Yeah, I used a little bit of that. The R2P. I talked about responsibility to protect in my introduction. And
oh,
Michael Ignatieff
okay.
was very much involved in that.
In that period, I guess it was, it was later in the early
yes.
part of 2001. He was still a dilettante, but very much a person who was backing the Dallaire vision of version of Rwanda. He wrote a book called, he wrote an article in the New York Times called The Burden, you know, The Burden. I mean, he didn't even, that didn't even bother him to use it. And he said, the burden that we have to protect other countries when they have failed states, and it's giving the role of helping other countries, but the fact is it's going in there to control these countries. I mean, that's what it is, and that is a tradition, as you were saying, is that's a tradition that was the justification for the scramble for Africa in the 1880s was we have to protect them against themselves. You know, we have to. They said we're going to fight slavery, or we're going to. You know,
yeah, despite the fact that they had, you know, self-sufficient autonomous governments that, you know, have pretty much been proven now that it was things were pretty good in Africa until colonialism started.
Well, yeah.
I mean, there were
slavery,
problems. Yeah, no, there were definite problems, but you know, things worsened quite rapidly after British intervention.
British and French and the European. I mean, but you see the I would say the ideology that behind it is we have to help these people, and you know, poor us, we've got to go there. And how do they do it? Is by making stories about peoples that are foreign, and you know, just saying, "Isn't that awful? Isn't that just awful? Look what they do to the, you know," and that's how they justified the worst colonial power grabs, and also which ended up often with massacres that people just pretend didn't happen, say 100 years ago, and they had at that time it was the church, but the church were there. They were do-gooders. They were going to go and
yes,
civilize.
Yes, the missionaries.
And we have the, you know, if you look at the discourse of many NGOs, it's just a repetition. It's sad to say, but it's just true.
I totally agree. Yeah, there's an article called that the NGOs are the new conquistadors in a sense.
Yeah, and you know, the often governments now they don't even hide the fact. They for instance, I remember in around the mid-90s, Joe was it? I guess no, it was just while they were still in power, the conservatives were still in power. Joe Clark would say, "The NGOs are our eyes and our ears." In other words, if that's not, you know, intelligence, what is? You know, the NGOs there are providing governments who are not there because it's, you know, they're not sheep, but they're more like wolves, you know, waiting to get the prey. And so, and that's where the NGOs, and if you try and get the NGOs to tell you the truth about what's going on, if they ever come out, often they'll just whisper it to you. I mean, I've had people who just said, you know, whispered it, but of course they have a vested interest, unfortunately, in not saying what's really going on. So.
Yes.
Hello?
Oh, hello. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. I guess the next part that I'd like to get into is, in your book you have interviews and testimonies from the former UN Secretary, General Boutros-Ghali, Jacques Boubou, the head of the United Nations Assistant Missions for Rwanda, who both really dispute this narrative of the singular genocide perpetrated by the Hutus against the Tutsis. In fact, most of the evidence that you provide in your book points to atrocities occurring on both sides. Can you give the audience some hard facts on what actually happened in Rwanda?
Well, you know, when the RPF invaded, they killed and chased away a large number of people, especially in the northern part of the country. And I've quoted some of the people. There's a very, very good book, and it's available in English. It was published by the University of Iowa Press by Beatrice Umutesi, and where she describes, and she came from northern Rwanda, she describes her situation fleeing from the RPF, first in the 1993 when they took over her town of Byumba, which is northern Rwanda, and how they operated and how they killed, and they would herd people into churches, and then they would kill the people. This was the RPF. This is before the period which has been since described as genocide. You know, this is February 1993, which I was talking about earlier. Her book then describes how they fled from there. They were living in shelters around Kigali until 1994, when the president was shot down. And at the same time, the RPF had already started moving their troops. In other words, it was led in a blitzkrieg to take over Rwanda, which is. They were the ones who broke the peace agreement that Dallaire was there to keep. And then in her book, she describes the steady fleeing from the RPF into Zaire, which is now the Congo, and then right further west. You know, if you look at the map going across the Kisangani, which is on the Congo, on the Zaire River, on the Congo River, and describes how each time, and they were chased like animals by the RPF, and the RPF would bomb the camps. They bombed these camps where there were up to 500,000 people near Goma, and she describes how it was in the, how they were chased and killed by the RPF. So it's, you know, there are reports by the UN which have been basically snuffed the reports. But there's a Gersony report about how the RPF was responsible for 30 or 40,000 killings during that period in April and May and after that, right through into the later 1994. And there are reports about what was going on in eastern Congo. So it's like, you know, to try and attribute the killing to one group is just so false. It's so erroneous. I mean, that's not the way things happened.
Yeah, and I guess what angers me in sort of reading commentary about your book is that, you know, you're accused of being a genocide apologist and all of these things. But in fact, you're not denying that the Hutus, you know, killed the Tutsis, but you're saying that the RPF also committed atrocities.
To put it down to, there definitely were groups who identified themselves as Hutus who went and killed Tutsis. I mean, of course, that did happen. But the group that was called the Interahamwe, which has been so demonized that you're afraid even to use it on the air, the head of the Interahamwe was a Tutsi, a guy named Robert Kajuga, to simplify the thing, there was a lot of other issues going on here. You had a situation where the RPF, as I said, was operating a guerrilla warfare and terrorist warfare during those years. And who were they recruiting? They were recruiting among Tutsi families, wealthy Tutsi families within in Kigali and elsewhere. You know, when the president's plane was shot down, there were 147 cells, active cells, operating in Kigali alone. Now, you know, in the FLQ crisis, there were two cells operating in 1970, and the Canada sent in the war measure, the army, and arrested all kinds of people. You just to realize. And so when the president was shot down, there was an absolute void of what went on. There were gangs of young people who had no homes, were out of school. They were living in refugee, internal displaced persons camps within Rwanda. And some of them, I mean, the gangs just went out, and there was a lot of killing going on, and there's just no doubt about it. But it's, you know, to say that some people, and of course no judges and no courts the ICTR have concluded that the government, the state, the army, did any planning of a genocide. So,
well, even Dallaire, you know, has previously stated that it was more political killings than ethnic, right? You mentioned that in your book.
He said that, and I've quoted it, and I still have the I have it on a CD of when he spoke. It was like the 14th of September 1994. He'd just gotten back, and that was how he described it, because he was on this sort of town hall meeting on the French TV, and somebody asked him about this. He said, no, it wasn't. It was like a more political in nature, the genocide. I mean, since then he reformed modified his story, because but at that time the story hadn't really gelled, you know, hadn't become the official story. It was still developing, you know, and the comparisons with Nazi Germany and stuff people had been talking about that. I mean, there were some of these NGOs who were out talking like that, but that hadn't become sort of like the accepted story, and it took a little longer until for instance, Israel accepted that other people could use the term genocide, which they haven't accepted for the Armenians, but they agreed in 1995 that, well, yes, we could, the Iranians could talk about a genocide, and that was when Kagame made his first trip to Israel and met with Netanyahu, I have a picture of it, in 1995. So in other words, but I mean, the official story took a while to really gel and become applicable and accepted by everybody. And so it's like now if you start saying, well, just a second, maybe that's not exactly what happened, well, they immediately call you a negationist.
Yes, and that's what you've been called, though I don't think anyone that said that has read your book, right?
Oh, some of them have because it's like, you know, if you're out to try and destroy somebody and destroy an idea, well, you have to try and then find, you'll be quoted out of context. And
yes.
A couple of years ago, I ran for politics, and the newspaper made a big thing by quoting out of context parts of my book. You know, that's an old trick, you know. I've not read the whole book. But, you know, it is a big debate, but it's one of these stories. You got to look for the truth. The worst thing to do in this kind of situation, when you know there was such a mess and so many people died, is to close the book and say, well, we know what happened. You know, mm-hmm. That's the worst thing. And that's what some of these people who are so quick to shout names and call us negationists or genocide apologists are doing. They're inviting repetition of these kind of things. You know, if we don't go look and say, well, now why did this happen and what exactly happened, well, then you're just asking it to happen again.
Okay. I wanted to go into what's going on in Rwanda today, maybe a little bit before we let you go.
Okay.
I just wanted to know. You mentioned in you talk a little bit about this in your book. How has the economy and the state of Rwanda changed under this new regime? And is this new regime more advantageous and more supportive of Western powers?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it is. You might call it an oasis for American British imperialism. And I think the French have realized that in order to get a piece of the cake, they've got to get behind the Americans, and that's why they have this sort of like reestablishment of relationships between France and Rwanda. They basically admit that the British and the Americans won, and they want to get in on it. So, but before 1994, there wasn't even a British consulate in Rwanda, and now it's the biggest embassy there. The British are very, very powerful in Central Africa. The Americans, of course, are very powerful. As I was saying, they've got a very big highway that goes from Goma through to Kigali now, and that's where you export all the wealth, the mineral wealth, which
yes.
is being taken out of the Eastern Congo. So, but there has been a very good study, and I think it's available in English, by a professor from Chicago and one from here in Montreal, Emmanuel Hakizimana, which shows that, in fact, the population of Rwanda has become much poorer than it ever was. You have pockets of wealth around Rwanda, but the agricultural population, which is 80-90% Hutu, is basically living poorer than it ever has. They've pointed out that, in fact, it's complete reversal. It's return to 1959, when the Tutsi minority ran a feudal monarchy, a feudal system in Rwanda. And you have that again, where you have this Tutsi minority, and a minority of the Tutsis, basically people who came from Uganda, not the Tutsis from within Rwanda, but they run the country. And with the result that the rest of the population is very, very poor.
And you mentioned in your book that the power structure of the country has also changed. It really, you know, privatization has occurred. There's a lack of autonomy.
Everything that happened, some people compared the social revolution in Rwanda to what they call a quiet revolution here in Quebec. You had a government played an important role. You had a way the Hutus were finally getting opportunities to go to university, get a good role in the economy, and that has completely been rolled back. In other words, I think also to understand Rwanda, there's this great historian. His name is René Le Marchand. In fact, he taught at the University of Florida for many, many years. And he said one thing you have to remember is that what do you call Black Africa, and Rwanda is the only country where there was a revolution with independence, and that is why. And what happened in 1994 is a counter-revolution. You know, there have been revolutions and counter-revolutions elsewhere. It's like they would have liked to have a counter-revolution in Cuba. France had revolutions and they had counter-revolutions, and that's what you had there because you actually had a revolution in 1960, whereas most of the other independences were carried out almost by a change of government. The imperialists said we're going to lose the country, so they tried to find a way to limit the damage. But where in Rwanda, you actually had a revolution and a change of the power structure. And now what you have in return is a return of almost, say, pre-1960.
Okay, finally, Robin, I'd like to get your opinion on the narrative of genocide and humanitarian intervention that we see in Rwanda. Do you see this connected to a new language of colonialism that might be repeated around the world, or that maybe is being repeated around the world?
Yeah, well, I would say that, first of all, it's not a useful term to talk about genocide because, unfortunately, in this case, and perhaps in others, because now I've noticed in order to get people's attention, you have to say genocide, and then people say, oh, boy, you know, Rwanda. But, you know, it doesn't help you, you know, it. And there have been a lot of studies about this, and philosophers who said, you know, this is not helpful, because you can talk about massive massacres and massive death, but if your object is to learn, is to prevent things from happening, well, then you can't, because that the assumption is that there was a good group and a bad group. There was one group of perpetrators and others who were victims. And, you know, it doesn't stand up to analysis in the case of Rwanda. You could say, we can say, then we do say about the Second World War, the Hitler and the Nazis wanted to eliminate the Jews, I think it is quite accurate to say that. It is accurate to say that, and to say that there was there were victims and there were perpetrators. But in Rwanda, it just does not stand up, and says that's why it's dangerous to use that, and it just makes people shut their eyes and turn their brains off when you use that kind of thing. And so, in other ways in the world, and you notice that people. Now it's with the word that it's the only word on which people are going to become active. Whereas you know, there are cases where we should be mad, in Palestine, Iraq, Afghanistan, to name a few. So the use of the word genocide in without any thought, combined with other. Roles, or in other words, that give imperial powers the right to go and make the law in other countries is very dangerous, and it's a repetition, I would say.
Well, thank you so much, Robin, for being here. I'm sorry if we've taken up so much of your time, but you've just provided such an interesting analysis, and I think that our listeners are incredibly grateful to have this perspective.
Really, thank you very much for. I'm glad to have people interested in it, and I think there's a lot more to be said, and there's more and more information available for people who do want to look for it.
And it's amazing that Robin, you've put the whole book up on the Taylor Report's website, so people can go on that. I think that's such an amazing gift to everyone.
Well, we did that because, in fact, at first we didn't find an English language publisher.
Okay.
The book came out in French here in Quebec, and it sold very well. It's been republished and was published in France. It was published in German, but we couldn't get an English language publisher, so Taylor Report agreed to put it up.
Well, yeah, it's amazing to me that so many of these things written about Rwanda, you can only get them in the French language. And I know Jacques Bobo wrote, a recent rebuttal to Dallaire. Has that even been published in English yet? I know it's in French.
There's the odd thing, the book by Beatrice Mutesi, but they don't get reviewed.
Yes.
There is a bit, but it's very, very hard to find, and it's just, it's it just shows that the publisher don't want to touch it, you know. So it was one of the reasons why I founded this new publishing house called Baraka Books, because but we haven't, you know, got any books on Rwanda out yet. But is it because there is a, well, it's part of control of information, I'd say.
And but this is very differently received, at least the Rwanda issue is very differently received, from my understanding, in French, Canada, and in Europe. Is that,
well,
is that
in
correct?
Quebec, yeah. First of all, in Quebec, Quebecers over the years, since the early 60s, you know, there was a Quebecer who founded the National University of Rwanda. It was there were a lot of international cooperation done between Quebec and Rwanda. So there are enough people who were there, who have a better understanding of the history of Rwanda, know more about it, but they don't just immediately go along with the official story. Now, I mean, there are a lot of people who do, and that's, I don't want to pretend it's otherwise,
yeah.
But there's a better, more critical understanding of Rwanda in Quebec than there is elsewhere, in Belgium and in France as well, and because of people have... You know, they know the country, but in the English-speaking world, Rwanda was like, you know, it was Timbuktu, you know, just mm-hmm. people didn't know where it was. And I don't think they knew the history, so that it was very easy to tell a story.
One is, you, I think you've mentioned in the book and in other interviews, Dallaire didn't even know where Rwanda was, right?
No, and he was proud. And it's almost because he said he didn't know where it was, that everybody said, oh, well, then he's even better.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
He should be embarrassed.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, anyway, thank you so much, Robin. We have to go. We're heading up
okay.
to the next show, but it was great having you. That was
thank you for inviting me.
Great. That was Robin Philpott, a journalist, author, and politician. We reached him in Quebec, and as we mentioned, his book is Rwanda 1994, Colonialism Dies Hard, and definitely check out the Taylor Report website to find the full copy of the book in English.